jubeos placit ad varis liberare manus.
Nobilis humilis manie martir stabilis habilis utilis comes serva carnis fragilis mole possitos.
Hi, this is Stan Brakhage. I wonder if you ever heard of Frei Jacinto. Frei Jacinto, I'm not even sure how to pronounce the name myself, so I'll spell it J-A-C-I-N-T-O, 18th century Portuguese composer. And probably you haven't heard of him. There's only two pieces of music that they've been able to find so far by this man, but they're both significant enough they've been preserved. He was a contemporary of Scarlatti and C.A. Zas, 18th century, and here is his remarkable sonata in D minor. One can suspect that this Frei Jacinto, or Jacinto, Portuguese 18th century composer, was so alarming to his contemporaries with music like that that they might have stoned him to death, and that's why we only have a few pieces from him. Beautiful and lyric as the piece is in a way, it's fraught with rhythms of belligerency and war rhythms, I would say. I'm no expert on them by any other but the ultimate study that most of my growing up, almost all, the radios carried to me the major sense of war rhythms, the urgency of them. Aside from the messages, which I often didn't understand, I understood the rhythms and their effect on the people and how they moved through human beings on the streets around me. It was my school of rhythm, of war. I give you just an example of it.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live.
Hello, this is Bert Simon speaking from Manila, and this time I've got a real scoop for you. Manila has just been bombed. Japanese bombers.
And now the flak is coming up in the sky. Looks like we're going to have a night tonight.
Another one coming over.
Last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel. In this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer.
So the rhythms need not necessarily be fast or swift. They can even be a certain pacing which leads straight to prayer. Human beings have been commissioned to make a war music, that is, a music that people will be not only willing but anxious to die to. Composers have made fortunes and made this their entire life of composition. I give you an example from the Civil War, replayed, of course, by the Eastman Wind Ensemble, Civil War war music. So, we have a music which is composed, but I think not by artists, because it's composed not to give a sense of something or a balance, but actually to affect people, to stir them up. I want to play for you another piece by Charles Ives, himself singing, which shows the excitement that a person can have, in this case, in the fever of the First World War, and out of Ives' patriotism, singing joyously of going over there to fight. We Are There is the name of the piece. But because he is and cannot help himself to be a composer, he really shows forth something of the horror of old men singing delightedly of war.
There's a time in many a life when it's due to visit them, but our soldier boy will do their part that people can live in a world where all will have the same. Their conscience always of their country's aim, which is liberty for all. Hip hip hooray, you'll hear them say as they go to the fight and run. Brave boys are now in action. They are there, they will help to free the world. They are fighting for the right, but when it comes to might, they are there, they are there, they are there. The deaf the allies beat the fall of our hearts. The boys be there, fighting hard, and then the world will shout the battle cry of freedom, chanting on a new campground. Chanting tonight, chanting on a new campground. For it's rallying round the flag of the people's new free world. Shouting the battle cry of freedom.
And so we have it, I think, as artists cannot help but make it a clarity, a whole sense, not only of the rhythm, but of something of what it leads to and of its even false grounds. Art also is useful for people to extract these rhythms of truth and to destroy the balance of rhythming and use again for propaganda. Hitler, for instance, studied carefully the 19th century theater, studied with the theatrical people of the Max Reinhardt tradition of theater, the rhetorical sense of theater, and honed all their gestures and their senses of voice into a masterpiece of propagandizing.
Hear Adolf Hitler speak.
Damals erhoben wir zum ersten Male als unbekannte Eiserner diesen Krieg zu beginnen und nicht zu ruhen, bis endlich diese Erscheinung aus dem deutschen Leben beseitigt sein wird. abgelehnt, jemals vor dieses Volk hinzutreten und billige Versprechungen zu geben. Glaube niemals an fremde Hilfe, niemals an Hilfe, die außerhalb unserer eigenen Nation.
And so he led a nation feverishly to war and finally sucked a whole world into it. And I think really essentially off these rhythmings. You know, people who actually have heard him speak have said that the movies that show him speaking, the newsreels that is, the recordings that have been made, don't capture even more than a little bit of the hypnotic power that he had. But my friend Eugene Salome, who experienced directly Hitler's speeches, and experienced them, by the way, as a determined spy against the Nazis throughout the whole Second World War, said that even he, with his determination and his full consciousness of his determination to destroy the Nazis, had to be very careful listening to Hitler, and that once he opened himself just a little bit during a speech, and like unbuttoning one button of his coat, and began to feel himself swept up in the Nazi enthusiasm. He has also told me that that little piece of recording I played for you is the closest he's ever heard, actually on record or tape or film, to something of the sense of the power of his speaking. So we have a sense of what the arts can do when imbalanced, and a sense of what they can do in the original. Artists are no more immune from war fever than anybody else. For example, I can't say that. Some are and some aren't. I think maybe it's a good moment to listen to see what Kenneth Patchen has to say from his Journal of Albion Moonlight this week.
14. What are we to do? How will we get to Roivus? We were not running away. That must be understood. It was essential that we bring our message to the people who had lost hope in the world. It was our duty to go into the villages and cities. Can't you understand? Our message was this. We live. We love you. Our religion is life. Flowers, brooks, trees. Now we are held here in the world, we'll perish because no one is saying, we love you. We believe in you. We believe in you. It's not getting dark. We love you. We are prisoners from the world. We who wanted only to go into the world with our arms open to all of you.
That's also a war poem that was written, that was begun at least during the Second World War, as he lay flat on his back with a whole society gone to him, mad around him, though that was, as you know, the just war, the Second World War. That was the war which seemed most to have to be fought, and which Patchen and some few others refused to have anything to do with. But then there are the poets who are extraordinarily belligerent, like our Portuguese composer, the young Ezra Pound, before the First World War, writes this: "Damn it all this our South stinks peace. You horse and dog papioles, come, let's to music. I have no life save when the swords clash, but ah, when I see the standards gold, vare, purple, opposing, and the broad fields beneath them turn crimson, then howls my heart nigh mad with rejoicing." That's from Stastina Altaforte. And that was done by Pound with a drum and with his voice more than I can make it for you. something more like this. In the hot summer have I great rejoicing when the tempests kill the earth's foul peace, and the lightnings from blank heaven flash crimson, and the fierce thunders roar me their music, and the winds shriek through the clouds mad opposing, and through all the riven skies God's swords clash. And so on for a number of other verses. But then let's listen to the pound of the cantos. A pound at the age of 87, having lived through two world wars after writing that poem, after having been incarcerated 12 years in an asylum rather than be tried for treason for his collaboration with the Italians during the Second World War, a man who devoted so much of his life trying to stop war in the meantime, and between those wars had written of the deaths of so many of his friends at the front, dear friends of his, so that this part of the cantos really is just an old man reminiscing, but still with that balance that it's not against war, that it concludes its jokes like getting it up, its kind of war front humor, its camaraderie, and yet lists off all that's been lost.
And because of that, son of a bitch, Franz Joseph of Austria, because of that, son of a bitch, Napoleon Barbish, they put him on Hill 70 in a trench dug through corpses with a lot of kids of 16 howling and crying for their mamas. And he sent a chit back to his major, I can hold out for 10 minutes with my sergeant and a machine gun. And they rebuked him for levity. And Henri Gaudier went to it, and they killed him and killed a good deal of sculpture. And old T.E.H. went to it with a lot of books from the library, London Library, and a shell buried him in a dugout. The library expressed its annoyance, and a bullet hit him on the elbow, gone through the fellow in front of him. And he read Kant in the hospital in Wimbledon in the original, and the hospital staff didn't like it. Maxi Larman went to it with a bit of heavy artillery, and the airman came down with a mitrailleuse and cleaned out most of his company. And a shell hit on his tin hut while he was out in the privy, and he was all there was left to that outfit. And Barham Vanderberg went to it, and he was out in the Aegean, down in the hold of his ship, pumping gas into a sausage. And the bosun looked over the rail down into amidships, and he said, "Geez, look at the captain. The captain's a-gittin' her up." And old Captain Corcoran went to it with his legs full of rheumatics so much so he couldn't run. So he was 6 months in hospital, observing the mentality of the patients. And Bimmy was 19 when he went to it, and his major went mad in the control bit about midnight and started throwing the phone about, and he had to keep him quiet till about 6 in the morning and direct that bunch of artillery. And Cyril Hamilton went to it too much in a hurry, and they buried him for 4 days.
And that still has carrying in it, though feebly and with some deep recognition, still it carries in it a rhythming belligerent aside from what's being said. Again, I don't know any better way to contrast than to hear some more from Kenneth Patchen, who managed that almost impossible and considered by most people cowardly thing to keep out of it altogether. Kenneth Patchen.
June 15. What horror can be greater than an army of monstrous dogs led by a human intelligence? They do not bark. They do not fight each other. They just watch us. Their eyes glow in the fields at night. The moon embrace her shepherd, and the queen of love her warrior, while the first doth horn the star of morn, and the next the heavenly farrier. With an host of furious fancies, where a lion commander, with a burning spear and a horse of air, to the wilderness I wander.
And so we have a peacefulness condensed entirely within this writing that he's doing at this period, and yet, as I said before, he was fighting also with his little circle of admirers against Kenneth Rexroth or Robert Duncan's or anyone else's in town in the 50s. But he had managed at least to make an area in which the rhythming was peaceful. Yet, it doesn't begin to touch the old woman, H.D., who had young Ben Ezra Pound's lover in a treehouse in Pennsylvania, who'd followed him across the ocean against her parents' wishes, who'd married otherwise and separated herself and fiercely retrieved her own poetics from his, who'd had an affair with D.H. Lawrence during the First World War, and who'd lived out a whole life and come finally to the peace of these lines in Helen in Egypt, where she's imagining all of it, those two wars, through the Greek-Trojan War.
Helena has spoken of the unreality of war, this phantasmagoria of Troy, as she calls it. But through her contact with Achilles, she finds reality. Achilles himself and the host of spirits who rescue her from him and in the end reconcile her to him. Much has happened in timeless time here in the Amen Temple, but he had not questioned me. He had never spoken of beauty. The rasp of a severed wheel seemed to ring in the dark. The spark of a sword on a shield, the whir of an arrow. The crack of a broken lance, then laughter mingled with fury as host encountered host. But that had never been. How long did he hesitate in time or in timeless time, while his fingers tightened their grip? Why did he let me go? Did he hear the whir of wings? Did he feel the invisible host surrounding and helping me? Was he afraid of the dead? This is the spread of wings. Whether the straits claim them or the Cyclades, whether they floundered on the Pontic seas or ran aground before the Hellespont, whether they shouted victory at the gate, whether the bowmen shot them from the walls, whether they crowded surging through the breach or died of fever on the smitten plain, whether they rallied and came home again in the worn hulks half rotted from the salt or sun-walked on the beach, whether they scattered or in companies or two or three sought the old ways of home, whether they wandered as Odysseus did, encountering new adventure. They are one. No, I was not instructed, but I read the script. I read the writing when he seized my throat. This was his anger. They were mine, not his, the unnumbered host. Mine all the ships, mine all the thousand petals of the rose, mine all the lily petals, mine the great spread of wings, the thousand sails, the thousand feathered dart that sped them home. Mine, the one dart in the Achilles' heel, the thousand and one mine.
Whatever sense I've been able to make of this, I wish to dedicate to Frank Georgiana and the production of Howard Barker's No End of Blame, an extraordinary play by a playwright unknown to me except for this production, a play which manages to wring some real hope, some careful, hard hope out of two world wars and the difficulties of living in the 20th century.